Okay, so the 10 o'clock hour is upon us, and I'd like to welcome you all to our telehealth webinar. I'm Freeman with Ackerman Marketing and PR, and we are glad that you all are here with us today. As we're all keenly aware, the interruptions to the healthcare delivery system caused by the global COVID-19 pandemic have resulted in a growth and expansion in telehealth. And with that said, we've brought together what we feel is a great panel of leaders, and we hope that this webinar will equip you with some practical ways to implement and utilize telehealth and what we're finding is our new normal, or as one of our panelists spoke this morning, our new abnormal. So let me introduce you to some of those experts. We have Kim Fryer, who is the Chief Executive Officer of University Physicians Associates here in Knoxville. UPA is throughout the Southeast, but headquartered here in Knoxville, and we're glad to have Kim with us here today. We also have David Jones, who is the Chief Financial Officer of Team Health, which is all across the nation, but we're proud that it's also headquartered here in Knoxville. Joy is an attorney and shareholder with Lewis Thompson, and he's very well versed in telehealth because that's one of his specialties. Also, we have Dr. Stephanie Vanderpool, who is the Director of Comprehensive Pain Services at the University of Tennessee Medical Center. She's an assistant professor of anesthesiology with the UT Graduate School of Medicine, and she's the medical director for the University Center for Pain Management, especially is a physician that is utilizing telehealth services. So thank you all for being with us today. So just kind of to set the stage, there's a special COVID-19 waiver that was put into play, and therefore telehealth services have become very popular. A survey was done that indicated that before the pandemic, only 1 in 10 patients utilized telehealth services, but now that's rapidly increased. And so, Justin, I'd like to turn it over to you to kick us off. For several years now, you've been counseling your physician clients on various legal matters relative to telehealth and telemedicine. So please share with us your perspective on the state of telehealth prior to COVID-19 and how all those involved with telehealth, especially physician healthcare providers, have had to quickly adapt to what's been caused by the pandemic.
Thanks, Erin, and it's great to be here this morning. I have been working with providers for a number of years at this point, talking about telehealth, and really my focus is on telemedicine. We may talk a little bit more about that somewhat subtle distinction later this morning, but in talking with providers about telemedicine over the past several years, quite frankly, the sanctuary has been fairly empty. But as you just said, over the past 3 or 4 weeks, the sanctuary has filled up very quickly with a lot of interest. I think there have been a number of barriers, not the least of which has been reimbursement to providers adapting telemedicine in their practice. And that's really been my focus, is working with small and mid-sized providers to incorporate telemedicine within their practice, to offer that as a convenience to patients, maybe to extend their practice capacity somewhat in terms of offering more hours of service and things along those lines that really don't create a large impediment from a capacity standpoint on their practice, but yet they can deliver care in a very convenient, high-quality way to their patients. But yes, to your point, really until about the past month or two, at least in my area of focus, which again is small and mid-sized private practices, there really has not been much in the way of adoption. And I think that has changed now from a matter of convenience to literally a lifeline for both patients and practices to continue to provide care during this extraordinary time. I think the developments that we've seen with CMS on the reimbursement side, some of the regulatory relaxations, I'm not sure that those will be durable after the pandemic in their current form, but what I think that they have done is made everyone aware of where the barriers were before, see what happens when those are removed, and now let's adjust those going forward longer term.
Kristen, you've mentioned before to me that there are some differences in telehealth versus telemedicine. So would you like to go into that explanation? Because I think a lot of people don't understand the differences between those.
Well, and Erin, it's really more of a legal difference from my perspective. To be sure, there's also some differences when you're talking about different categories for reimbursement. I think we've got a slide. Ryan, if you could put that up, at least to what Tennessee's definition is about telemedicine. It's fairly lengthy, so if we can get the slide up, that'd be great. But it really says what the state medical board defines telemedicine. And again, from my perspective, as a legal matter, there are a number of legal considerations with that, because if you're practicing telemedicine, then you are practicing medicine. And that's one of the big things that I try to emphasize to providers that I work with, is that there's nothing virtual about virtual medicine. So if you're doing something that meets the definition of telemedicine from the medical board that we have here, then you are practicing medicine. And by statute, under Tennessee law, you are held to the same standard of care as if you're seeing that person in your office. So as we see here in this definition, that it is the practice of medicine. You just happen to be using electronic communication to deliver that care. And if we can flip to the next slide, we also see what telemedicine is not. And under Tennessee regulations, telemedicine is not an audio-only telephone conversation. It's not an email or instant messaging conversation or fax. Now, when you talk about things like audio-only telephone conversations, email and instant messaging, so-called asynchronous communications or store-and-forward communications, some of that falls under the broader umbrella of telehealth. And CMS and some private payers have expanded their coverage in that area of the more broader area of telehealth, which may include things like remote monitoring and mobile health with mobile apps and things along those lines. But it, in my view, and really my focus has been on telemedicine, because again, when a provider is doing something where they have a patient-provider relationship that constitutes telemedicine, they are practicing medicine.
Kicking that off for us there. David, want to flip to you to speak to the perspective of Team Health. Team Health is one of the largest integrated healthcare providers in the country with more than 16,000 clinicians. So speak to us about the effects the COVID-19 crisis has had on healthcare as a whole and the effects that have caused the need for the telehealth services.
Sure. Thank you, Erin. So just a little background at, Team Health, our primary focus is really hospital-based staffing, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners. And we started off staffing the emergency department. Actually, UT Medical Center was our first client 40 years ago and still work with them. So that was our original focus and really still continues to be our largest area. But we've also over the years moved into anesthesia and hospital medicine. We also do some medical services in post-acute settings as well. So like everyone in healthcare, we have seen significant declines in utilization really across all specialties. We really saw that starting mid-March, which really aligns with some of the initial social distancing orders. But we've seen some further deceleration of utilization continuing into April. And I would say from our perspective, anesthesia probably was the most impacted, most immediate, as you saw the deferral of elective surgeries. But from my perspective, surprisingly, you know, we've seen really significant drops in things like ED visits. And I've been doing this 26 years. I would have never thought ED visits would be really considered discretionary or elective. But in some cases, we're seeing declines upwards of 40%. So I think some of that loss of volume, you know, could be explained by the stay-at-home orders and you know, you're not out and about and the things that sometimes contribute to having to go to the emergency department, car accidents, sports injuries. You know, those are more limited. But I think we're seeing some concerning reports in the media and other press that there's a lot of patients that are having a serious fear of COVID infection and are not going to the hospital despite really serious medical conditions like strokes, heart attacks, et cetera. So I think we're going to see in hindsight, you know, a lot of, you know, mortality that's attributed to things that could otherwise have been prevented if folks had gone. So what we sort of were planning this, you know, what we thought we'd see was this huge surge of COVID patients coming into these ERs. And we're really not seeing that, even in some of the hot spots we operate in, like Washington State, New York City, Detroit. But we are seeing COVID patients show up. So the whole ED is really transformed. We're seeing less patients, but the acuity mix is much higher. A lot of hospitals are repurposing their emergency departments. In some ways, they're operating as a de facto ICU. People that aren't able to get onto the, you know, the floor of the hospital are being held in the ER for much longer than normal. And in the current environment, we're really focusing a lot of attention on the health and safety of our clinicians. We're doing a lot of work to try to procure, you know, adequate personal protective equipment. So that's a little bit the background we're operating in, and everybody's, you know, sort of monitoring it daily. As it relates to telemedicine, really due to the more acute element of most of our specialties, it's really not been a big part of our care delivery model. You know, most of what our physicians do tends to be, you know, immediate, on hands, not a real long-term relationship with the patient, like you might see with the primary care provider. But we have seen the need to stand up some telemedicine options. And so really over the last several weeks, we have internally developed a lot of policies, guidelines, and supporting materials that we can provide to our providers. So despite that increased capacity, we're still seeing fairly limited activity with telemedicine. Probably the most significant element that we're seeing is in some of our post-acute facilities where they've actually locked everything down. And so physicians who would normally go and make rounds in those facilities are having to use telemedicine as an option. You know, we're also seeing it some, as you see some of these triage tents that have been set up outside hospitals, where you can use telemedicine there for the initial EMTALA screening, where you don't have the patient actually get exposed by coming into the facility through use of telemedicine where they can communicate with the physician at that point. So from our standpoint, significant change in health delivery, significant changes in the utilization environment. And, you know, I think we are obviously going to see some more and more use of telemedicine in that environment.
That's an excellent transition to Dr. Vanderpool, who as a physician is dealing with day in, day out firsthand. So Dr. Vanderpool, as a physician that practices IET Medical Center and medical director of University Center for Pain Management, talk to us about how healthcare providers have had to quickly adapt to the changes the pandemic has caused to the patient care delivery model. And as the recommendation for elective procedures to be postponed and that transition had to be made to telehealth visits, provide us with your thoughts on the ease or the lack thereof of that transition and what have been the biggest challenges, and just talk to us about what resources have been helpful to you and your patients as well as your practice.
Thank you, Erin. Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that this entire transition from seeing patients on a Friday in person to seeing patients on a computer on a Tuesday is a very rapid bullet train transition. So we had a lot of learning to do, and I want to stress a couple of things while we go through the process, and that was the importance of team communication and iterations. We're not going to get it perfect when we're doing it for the very first time. And so I'll talk a little bit about what our team did at the University Center for Pain Management to iterate and continue to improve best practices and establish them. But then the second thing is communication with patients and making them aware that these services are available. So first of all, in my field, in terms of chronic pain management, our patients' pain doesn't stop just because we can't see them in practice. And while it's not acute, they're not coming into the ER with life or limb issues. They are still dealing with pain that interrupts their quality of life and makes them not able to function the way they want to. So when we had to cancel our procedures because of the responsibility we had as healthcare providers to protect patients and comply with cancellation of elective procedures, we had many, many patients who were extremely disappointed that they couldn't get the relief they were looking forward to. What we had to do then is make sure that we had a way to, number one, stay in touch with them, see if there was anything we could do to mitigate what they were experiencing in terms of the interruption in their function and the level of pain, but also not re-precipitate a crisis like we've been trying to get out of with the opioid crisis. So this was not just a, oh, don't get your injection, take some more pain medicine. This was, let's make sure that we're figuring out exactly what's causing your pain, and let's make sure that we're targeting the source of pain as best we can, even if we can't do an injection today. So in terms of transitioning from inpatient or in-person visits to telehealth, the first thing we had to figure out was, did we have the capacity? And thankfully, our electronic medical record had a built-in telehealth integration that we were able to get up and running very quickly. So as soon as we realized that we were going to have that need, we were on the phone and on the help desk with our EMR to make sure that we were establishing our telehealth capabilities. We also had to quickly establish an ability to prescribe controlled substances electronically because we couldn't fax or call those in. The second thing that we had to do is we had to make patients aware that this was an option. That required updating our websites. It required making some notifications to our patients, calling those patients who we had to cancel or reschedule and letting them know that telehealth was an option or telemedicine was an option if they were looking, if they would like to see us so that they had an opportunity to schedule. We also had in the midst of this to not just transition from to seeing patients at home, but also to working from home because of the responsibility we had to socially distance and protect our team members. So we had to figure out a way to continue our communication as a team while also being able to seamlessly deliver patient care. And so one of the keys to that was inter-office communication that we use. The model we use is Slack, but there are other things out there such as Microsoft Teams or other HIPAA-protected chat apps that allow us to communicate almost instantly with other team members on our network, no matter where they are. That was critical because as you have questions about patients, my nurse practitioners still ask me questions about patients while they're seeing them. I'm able to answer and respond in a timely fashion. In terms of resources, it's critical to get out there and participate in things such as this webinar, because there are going to be pockets of information that some people may have a high level of detail on that others may not. So I personally have probably attended at least 10 or 12 webinars since the start of this COVID pandemic and have picked up something from every single one of them that I've been able to take back to the practice to help us streamline and implement. And the other thing that I wanted to make sure I kind of highlighted on it at the beginning of my comments is that we, during the first week of starting telehealth visits, every afternoon we had a debrief via Zoom with the team to go over what worked, what didn't work, what we needed to improve upon. And we documented that into a best practices document, which we then shared with the team. So communication, iteration, and just being flexible. Those are the keys, I think, to being able to get this up and running quickly.
Thanks so much, Dr. Vanderpool. You are always an example of doing things the right way and efficiently, and that's why you have such a good practice. So, Kim, you with UPA, you represent hundreds of physicians across East Tennessee, and you're trying to, right now, well, UPA as a whole, you are very well versed in helping them from an operational standpoint. Billing to insurance to contract negotiations. So in terms of telehealth, what have you been hearing from your physicians and how has UPA helped them with the transition?
Well, to go based on what Dr. Vanderpool said, she's exactly right. You know, we have 1,100 providers in 160 locations. So each provider office has a different level of skill set, electronics, everything. So everybody has a variety of levels. So we basically have just kind of turned into more of a resource for our providers and trying to put together, you know, what what codes do you need to use? What payers are paying what? To where we can help them with our IT, working with UT's IT, to make sure that everybody has the resources they need. But it's a variation. Some have Zoom. Some have things built into their EHR that works great, like Dr. Vanderpool was stating, but others don't. We've had some that have to do it based on FaceTime and things of that nature. So, you know, it's really trying to help each of these groups figure out what resources they have, what they can tap into, and how we can help them make sure that they're providing the best care that they can, and also be paid for that in the long run with our contract. So we've put together a lot of resource material. We've communicated daily. We have daily calls. We have daily information that goes out to everybody, because as everybody knows right now, you know, the question you may answer today may have a different answer tomorrow. Everything is changing minute by minute. And we've been thrust into this. I mean, we've tried to do telehealth, telemedicine for years. I think, as Justin had said, you know, there for a while, it was, you know, one here, one there. And then all of a sudden, it's almost, you know, 75% of your practice in primary care offices for preventive visits and things of that nature that had changed. You didn't have those coming in, but we've still, you know, we're under all of these managed care contracts that are based on risk and all of these preventive things that you're doing. And then all of a sudden you're not allowed to do those things. So we're still having to kind of look at that from that risk contract arena as well. How do we make sure that these patients get the preventive care that they need during this time? But so we've really just kind of, you know, we've put together resources like these, you know, where we've sent to everybody, here's your contracts, these are everything, this payer does this, this payer does that, because they're all different. There's no uniformity in any of that. So, you know, we've just really kind of turned into more, we've always been a resource, but we've really been a resource to those that we do billing for and things of that nature. But we have shared that information with everyone, because all of our providers, you know, they may use different billing services. So I would encourage you to go to your billing service, ask them what, you know, how they can help you, because that's very important right now to make sure that, you know, you're doing what you need to be doing, but we're trying to maximize some of that in your expenditures versus your what you're bringing in as well. Because that's what, you know, that's where everybody's suffering right now, is just not being able to, you know, collections are down, charges are down for everybody across the, you know, across the United States. So we've got to try to figure out, how do we maximize that?
You know, one thing that you all have spoke of are the changes that have occurred. So Dr. Vanderpool, speaking of patients having to get used to not being in the office anymore, to communicating with their physician, like we're communicating right now through Zoom. Kim spoken of the changes that have had to be made relative to billing codes and how different insurance companies are handling this. David has spoken of the changes in the ED utilization and how that has gone down in comparison to what we thought it would be. So with all of these changes that have occurred, it's going to be difficult. We probably won't ever go back to how things were. So I'd like for you all to share your thoughts on, you know, how is telehealth going to change the future of healthcare? So Justin, if you want to kick it off, and then the rest of you just add in as you would like.
Erin, I think at the end of the day, the changes are largely going to be driven by the patients and the payers. If the insurance companies roll back, frankly, to where they were before the pandemic, if CMS slows down its expansion of covered codes, then I'm not sure that the adoption rate will continue to increase as it has over the past few weeks. I think, however, that patients, and I've heard from a number of patients actually over the past 2 or 3 weeks that have had telemedicine visits for the first time, and they enjoyed it. You know, they, instead of a 30-minute drive to the doctor's office and, you know, perhaps a 15-minute wait for a 5-minute consultation, it's a 5-minute consultation from their desk. And I think if payers can make that happen and providers can be efficient with that, and there are ways to be efficient with telemedicine, it takes a little practice. As Dr. Vanderpool said earlier, no one's going to get this perfectly starting off. And it really is a matter of continuous improvement, sharing the information like Kim was talking about. But I think as providers become more comfortable with this, patients become more comfortable with this, and payers realize that this is a valuable way to deliver care, I think the future of telemedicine is bright. I've said this could be telemedicine's shiny moment to demonstrate its value to both patients and providers. And I think on both sides of the virtual visit, people are liking this. So I think it's here to stay. I do think, like I said earlier, that there's a number of things both on the reimbursement side and also on, say, the HIPAA side. HIPAA is another focus of mine, and it becomes very complex when you start to set these systems up, whether you have an integrated system like Dr. Vanderpool's practice or you have providers that are using FaceTime. Right now, it's basically all okay as long as it's not an open communication platform. As long as it's one-to-one, there is an enforcement waiver in place right now where the Office for Civil Rights within HHS that enforces HIPAA has said, if you're using this in good faith, we're not going to come after you. We want you to use telemedicine during this crisis. But I think once that enforcement waiver goes away, it is important for practices to understand going forward what their requirements are to set their system up securely, to maintain privacy, and to meet their regulatory obligations. So I think, you know, again, looking forward, I think the future is bright for telemedicine, but we're obviously in a very unusual time right now, and providers will need to continue to improve how they use it now, but also adapt to the changes that happen going forward.
I completely agree, David. I think a lot of, or Justin, I'm sorry, where a lot of this is going to go will really be dependent on the managed care plans and Medicare. I think what they're seeing today is, you know, it is, you know, all hands on deck, everybody, you know, just do what you need to do to take care of the patient. And I think the providers are enjoying it. I know the patients are. I've heard from quite a few, and I agree with you. I think they really are enjoying it. But I think basically what they're going to have to do is we're going to have to come up with some kind of uniformity. And I think that's where we are. Every, you know, looking at my grid, I mean, every one of these has done something a little bit different. So I think that's where Medicare is going to come in and kind of help guide that. And, you know, there's going to have to be a lot more restrictions around it. You know, not everybody has a built-in platform in their EHR. I think that will be something that we'll see change. I think we'll see some of those kind of step up, but I know there's going to be some legislation out there where folks are working on right now to try to get telemedicine, telehealth as something, you know, that we can use easier long-term, because we have been thrown into this. And I think we've done a marvelous job. I've seen, I'd say probably 90% of the practices that we bill for are using telemedicine very efficiently, and have been able to offset a lot of those lost costs. So I think, you know, we've got to find the balance of being able to do that. And I think, you know, it's like everything else. If we have folks that abuse it, then we're gonna struggle with it a little bit. But I think if everybody uses it the way we've designed it to be, I think it's going to work out great. And I do agree with you. I think this has been that will be one of the good things that does come out of this, I think, is that we'll be able to use a new platform to see our patients more efficiently.
Yeah, I would echo that. I view COVID as sort of the icebreaker moment here for telehealth. And I sort of liken it to, you know, the first time I used Uber, I probably had the app on my phone a year or two, and I wasn't always comfortable with the idea of getting in someone else's car. And then you do it and it's, wow, this is easy, convenient, and very streamlined. So it's that, you know, that new experience you overcome. Yeah, I do think that certain specialties obviously will probably be more applicable. You know, there's still, I think medicine's still a physical, hands-on experience, and the patients and the providers want that. But clearly the technology, I don't think, is a limiting factor. You've got very sophisticated, you know, telehealth platforms that you might see in hospitals that have, you know, clinical attachments and things like that, diagnostic attachments, or something as simple as Zoom. So that's not the limiting factor. I think you've heard time and again, you know, probably the primary issue is the uncertainty and the patchwork for reimbursement. But then if you start even going beyond, you know, multiple states, you've got credentialing issues, licensing issues, differences on prescribing rights and, you know, what you can and can't prescribe. and issues around patient consent. So there's still a lot of the regulatory issues that need to be addressed, as well as the reimbursement, to really get this, you know, going in the right direction to be more impactful than it has been in the past.
And I would echo what David and Kim and Justin have said, because I think as a physician practicing telemedicine, a few things have come to mind. The first is that we have to be very meticulous in our documentation of what type of encounter it was and what precautions and consents we obtained from the patient when we did the encounter. So we've actually created auto texts that we are able to make sure are included in every note to document that this was a telemedicine visit. The patient did provide verbal consent. We confirmed their state and city and where they were located at the time, things of that nature, just for the prolonged or for the posterity of documentation. But ultimately, I do believe that telemedicine does provide an advantage for certain types of patients. Those would be patients for whom a history and a visual physical exam can, by and large, give the majority of your diagnosis and initial treatment plan. I've had several patients, some of whom I was able to see for the very first time as a new patient, who I just did follow-ups on, and they've already reported 60% improvement in their pain just based on the fact that we were able to make a diagnosis from history and visual physical exam and make a treatment recommendation while we're waiting to resume elective procedures. So there is a way to make an impact on patients' lives using this technology, but we have to be judicious. Like Kim said, we can't overutilize it or use it when we are for inappropriate patients. So we need to be thoughtful about what types of patients we schedule for the visits and how we go about documenting them. And we also want to make sure that we continue with the live video component. I think Justin has referred to different types of telemedicine or telehealth, but ultimately for this to be beneficial, we need to have the live video component. You can see so much more from the patients when you have the video and not just over the phone. It is critical to be able to maintain that. So the more we can educate our patients on how to get access to that, whether that means downloading an app or implementing it, or even providing assistance on our websites. We have a frequently asked questions document and a telehealth primer document on our website, www.ucpmk.com. That just helps our patients with Zoom, but other practices may find it useful if they're also using Zoom to help patients understand how to download, how to log in, and so on. Because the more streamlined we can make the front-end connection, the more time we can spend with the patient on the visit and continue to maintain our efficiencies.
And if I could add just a point or two on those great thoughts, Dr. Vanderpool, when I'm talking to providers that are starting telemedicine, in some cases providing reminders to those that have been doing telemedicine for a while, to your point about the documentation, I try to analogize the virtual visit as much as possible to the in-office visit. So everything that you would do with that patient sitting there in front of you, you need to be doing when you are having your remote visit, which primarily includes documentation and documenting the same way that with that virtual visit that you would remotely, excuse me, in the office, because if there is a problem, so if there's a liability question or if a claim is made, you want to be able to demonstrate, number one, why you didn't touch the patient. Well, you didn't touch the patient because they were 15 miles away and this was by telemedicine. It's required to document it by telemedicine by regulation, but you should do that as a good practice anyway. And then secondly, you need to make it clear as to why this was an appropriate visit for telemedicine. Again, going back to that clinical judgment and the standard of care, I'll say it again, there's nothing virtual about virtual medicine, and it is very important from a liability perspective that providers fully understand that and not take this casually. Aaron, going back to one of the points that you, I think, raised earlier about the adoption of this going on right now, I think that is one concern that I have, is that providers that are new to this, that may be using it as a bridge to continue to deliver care, I think that's fair enough. But I would caution providers that are doing this in any kind of a casual manner. Yes, it's beneficial that we have the waivers in place from CMS and from HHS on the HIPAA side, but that doesn't mean that there's anything casual about this. This has to have the same level of thought and the same level of care, just like you would if that patient was in your office. It's not something to be taken casually.
So while telemedicine has enabled patients to re-engage with their healthcare providers during this pandemic, how do you all how do you all soothe patients' anxieties as well as physicians on when they're actually going to be able to re-engage with their healthcare organization in a personal format? I think a lot of patients have anxiety of when they're going to get to go back to see their doctor in person. So if we could wrap this up by speaking to that, and when do you all think, what is the timeline for elective procedures to begin again?
I can take that question as a starter. There's much discussion going on right now about when and how to resume elective procedures. Some are saying it might be as soon as within a couple of weeks. Some say it may be longer. It also depends realistically, because this webinar is likely going to be viewed outside of the state of Tennessee. It depends very much so on the community burden of COVID-19, whether or not the healthcare utilization is at surge levels or high utilization of PPE or personal protective equipment. All of these things have to factor into our consideration of when to resume elective procedures. There was a joint statement put out by several societies regarding resumption of elective procedures, and that went out on 4/17. You can find it on the American Society of Anesthesiologists website, amongst others, and it lists a roadmap for the things that need to be considered before elective procedures can be resumed. With regards to your initial question about how do we soothe patients' concerns, I think the main thing to let the patients know is that, number one, we are available and here for them. So when we see our patients as telemedicine visits, we let them know that we are available for future follow-ups. We actually will go ahead and, if they would like, schedule them a follow-up visit, letting them know that if we are able to see them in person, we'll convert it to an in-person visit if appropriate, but they know that they have a point of contact with us if anything else arises, and also letting them be aware that we are still available via phone, via messaging through the portal, and so on. I think just letting the patients know that we are available does a lot for them. And then also just being responsive. So when patients do inquire, if patients call your practices, try your best to be responsive, even more so than you would be during regular clinical business hours, because that means a lot to the patients to keep them engaged and connected with your practice and the fact that you do care about them and their well-being.
Yeah, I think I would speak from some of the anesthesia practices we work with. It definitely is a state by state and hospital by hospital decision in terms of resumption of elective surgeries. And we are starting to hear certain markets are at least looking to, you know, over the next week or so, resume certain types of elective surgeries. So I think it will be, again, staged. I do think as it relates to the ED utilization, I think as you continue to see some of these articles that I mentioned earlier about really severe acute issues not getting appropriate and timely treatment, I think you may see some hospitals locally start to, you know, put out some marketing around, you know, the need to, you know, make sure if you've got a chronic or an acute issue, don't wait. There's certainly a legitimate concern about going to a facility, but the protocols being followed are going to keep people safe, and the risk of not getting something treated far outweighs the potential risk of exposure going to the hospital. So I think some of that messaging will start to get out over the next couple weeks as well. So, you know, we do think, you know, in the second quarter, you're going to see a fairly significant fall off in utilization. But if you look at, patterns in other countries from SARS and other things, there is this, you know, rebound that occurs. And I think elective surgeries will probably be the first. And then other procedures will gradually recover over the third and fourth quarters.
Kim and Justin, do you have anything to add relative to timeline?
We're seeing we're having a lot of discussion with some of our offices now, and of course they're asking for recommendations, and we're really following the CDC guidelines, and we're relying a lot on our local health department, which they've echoed what David has said, is please make sure that you go for these, you know, chronic conditions. Don't wait. I think some of what we're seeing is, you know, people have waited a little too long to go in for some of these emergency issues. But I think there's going to be a lot of discussion, and it is going to be, you know, office by office, because all of ours are independent. You know, we don't employ these folks, so we can't say you are not going to open until X. So we're just trying to give some guidance based on, you know, CDC guidelines and what our local markets are dictating, and just basically being there to try to help them make those decisions and put the things in place that does make it all work.
CMS came out, as everyone may know, I believe Monday or maybe Sunday of this week, with some phase one reopening guidance that I would suggest providers take a look at. I think a lot of it is hopefully common sense, but at the same time, it's also a good checklist to go through and maybe provoke some thoughts about reopening that not everyone is thinking of, given everything else that's going on right now, but especially for those providers that have largely closed their practice to in-person visits. I think that is a good checklist to go down to make sure that they're all set to resume seeing patients in the office. But from a liability perspective, I think, to Dr. Vanderpool's point, I think keeping in touch with patients is very important now more so than ever. Really, from a continuity of care perspective, I think that there can potentially be, unfortunately, some liability questions that come up that if that continuity of care is broken, especially if we look at the unfortunate prospect of a second wave and having to close again at some point, maintaining that level of care throughout the patient relationship is more important now than ever, despite all the challenges around us. But I think that telemedicine can be a very useful tool, or telehealth for that matter, with e-visits and virtual check-ins to keep that patient-provider relationship going.
One more thing is that I do think that there's going to need to be for some time a hybrid along the lines of thoughts about reopening. Even when we reopen, we're still going to want to maintain social distancing. So for those offices that may not have an abundance of floor space, for example, our office is considering having one provider on telemedicine and one provider seeing patients in the office. So instead of turning over two rooms for one provider now has six rooms where we can keep the patients distanced, keep the flow, and clean the rooms appropriately in between. And then the other one is seeing patients on telemedicine and they can flip-flop. That way we're protecting patients, protecting staff, maintaining appropriate social distancing. However, that will require the payers to maintain reimbursement for telemedicine past the quote-unquote reopening of cities or counties or states. Because even though we reopen, we still have to maintain protective measures. So I think it's critical for healthcare lawmakers, policymakers, providers, insurance payers to understand that just because communities or hospitals may open does not mean that we can relax the social distancing and protective measures we've put in place.
That's an excellent point, Dr. Vanderpool. And thank you to all of you for joining us today. You all have provided a plethora of different types of insight into how we're handling the pandemic, how we move forward, and what the future could look like. For those of you that have joined us, our participants, please know that we've recorded this webinar. We will be posting it to our website and sending it out so that you can share it with your colleagues. We hope that today has been helpful to you all. Once again, thank you to our panelists. It's been a good webinar, and we appreciate your participation, not precipitation. Excuse me. So thank you all again for joining us. Everyone, stay safe, stay healthy, stay sane, and we'll all get through this together. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.